The last 18 hours of the Lord's life were filled with events of great import and importance to the disciple, and they still hold that same place of importance in the lives of those who follow Jesus today. The Last Supper that he ate was spent with his disciples. His hours in the Garden of Gethsemane were spent as fleeting moments with his Father. And then his arrest and trial and crucifixion was all at the hand of his enemies. And these all interacting with each other and his response to the relationship that he held with each one of these groups or people can all teach us something about this one's life. We've been studying for the last few weeks. We've been delving into and investigating the actions and the words and the teachings of this man, Jesus of Nazareth, during those last 18 hours. And we've been giving special emphasis to those events and sayings that throw light on his ministry. And then making an application to our own ministry as we further prepare ourselves to expand and enhance and polish our own service to one another, and as we prepare for the influx of some 2,500 young people, we're going to need whatever preparation we can get in order to minister to these people, in order to purge ourselves from everything that's ignoble, Paul says, so that we might be vessels ready for every good work. That's what we need to be doing. And so tonight, I want us to continue our study into this period of the 18 hours before Jesus' death. It was announced tonight that we were going to study on the subject of the Comforter. But circumstances changed and prevent this, I think. I couldn't get a handle on it, frankly, especially in terms of the study that we've been doing concerning the ministry of Jesus and how it relates to the study of the Comforter. And that was my fault, but I just couldn't get a handle on it to use it in the light of what we've been studying. And then there were other subjects that I knew also had a great bearing on the ministry of Jesus, and that one of those subjects being prayer. And so I was torn between the two of those, not knowing which one to preach on first, because we've only got tonight and next Sunday night before this series will conclude. And then my mind kept reverting back to John the 13th chapter, the first 17 verses, because this is such a vital part of the Christian ministry. It's such a vital part of the life of the Lord. It's such a beautiful incident in his life that throws such an illuminating light upon his ministry, upon his service, this washing of the feet of the disciples. And having received a 7-page single space typed letter from a person, a sister of mine in the Lord, who has charged me with failing to minister to her as I should, not from this congregation, from another city, my attention, to say the least, was riveted to John the 13th chapter. I don't believe that she was right, but I'm not here tonight to defend myself at all. Whether she's right or not, the subject needs to be investigated, and I need to do some inventorying, and I know that you do too. And this 13th chapter of John is where the focal point of ministry to one another really finds expression. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And during supper, when the devil had already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, and girded himself with a towel. Then he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. He came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, "Lord, do you wash my feet?" Jesus answered him, "What I am doing you do not know now, but afterward you will understand." Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, you have no part with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." Jesus said to him, "He who has bathed does not need to wash except for his feet, but he's clean all over. And you are clean, but not all of you." For he knew who was to betray him, and that was why he said, "You're not all clean." When he had washed their feet and taken his garments and resumed his place, he said to them, "Do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you are right, for so I am. If I, then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example, that you also should do as I have done to you. Truly, truly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them." In this reading, we are privileged to witness an event in the life of the Lord that is so very meaningful. This washing of feet stands out in bold relief as an example of meaningful ministry. You know, we talk about ministering to people and we pat them on the back and we say hello and we ask them, if there's anything that I can do for you, let me know and call me if I can help you, or come to see me sometime. And we go through a whole lot of these meaningless expressions. Maybe they're not always meaningless, but they are ways that we get by and slip on through without someone nabbing us and saying, "Yes, there is a way I can use you. You can be of help to me. It's this particular way." We kind of slip through with these meaningless mouthings of words that really sometimes don't really mean much. This example of Jesus' ministry to these disciples is a perfectly beautiful and complete example of meaningful ministry. The occasion was a leadership seminar, or a what you might call a minister's workshop. Now, you won't get that from just reading the account, and really that's not what it was called. They met there to eat the supper. But if you'll notice real quickly, these men were the ministers that Jesus was sending out into the world. These men were the leaders of the future kingdom. And here they were now all together, all 12 of them, and Jesus. And they had come together, it seems, for some last-minute briefing, some last-minute instructions. They had come together for a cementing of themselves together into a unified force. So much was needed to be done. There was so little time to do it. So many things needed to be said, so many ideas needed to be broached, so many things needed to be focused. There was so much to be done, and so much depended upon these men. And I think probably you could kind of say that this was a leadership forum. It was a minister's workshop. It was an effort to get these men brought together and to get them united in a single direction. But Luke records something here that John doesn't mention. This body of men, these future leaders, these ministers of Jesus Christ, these ones whom Jesus had selected to do his extension work after he had gone, These men were involved in a nasty incident that speaks ill of them. Luke says in his 22nd chapter that after the supper, an argument arose among them as to who was the greatest among them. Can you imagine it? We've discussed it before. Here these men now, upon whose shoulders the success of the kingdom depended, and they were the ones that were in this slot of such importance, and you might think, well, now here out of this meeting will come some real bold thinking and some real selfless leadership. And then after the reference to the death of Jesus and his body being given as bread and his blood being drink, after all of this had been mentioned to them, and then you find them turning from the noble to the ignoble, you find them turning from the sublime to the ridiculous, as they have the audacity to start grumbling and arguing with each other about who was the greatest among them. The seriousness of it can be seen from the fact that this is the third such argument or quarrel that was found to be among these brethren in the last 3 weeks. As they were approaching Capernaum some 3 or 4 weeks prior to this time, they were arguing on the road about it. When they got into the house, Jesus said, "What were you talking about on the way?" But they wouldn't tell him because they were ashamed, and I should hope so. After they left Capernaum, James and John were not to be outdone, and they got their mother to go with them, and they went to Jesus and said, "We've got something we want you to do for us." That's in Mark, the 10th chapter. He said, "What is it? What can I do for you?" And they said, "We want you to make it so that John and I, or that these two sons of mine, really will sit on your right hand and your left and in your kingdom when you come in your glory." Jesus said, "You don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I'm to drink?" They said, "We're able." "Are you able to be baptized with the baptism that I've got to be baptized with?" They said, "Yes." He said, "Well, you will. You'll drink the cup and you'll be baptized with the baptism, but to sit on my right and my left hand is not for me to give." Well, that didn't stop them. We find them going on through Jericho and staying with Zacchaeus that day, and then coming on to Bethany and being in the home of Lazarus and Mary and Martha and Simon the leper. And then we find them on toward the crucifixion, toward the Passover, and then this night of the supper, and we find them eating the bread and drinking the cup in the projected memory of the death of Jesus, and we find them still bringing up the subject of who was the greatest among them. John, though he doesn't record the argument, John records Jesus' answer. Jesus answered them by washing their feet. That was his answer to them. John, the 13th chapter, verses 1 through 3, give the background that show the magnitude of this action of the Lord. Listen to it. "Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And during supper, when the devil had already put into the heart of Judas, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that his Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose from supper, laid aside his garments, and girded himself with a towel." That's through verse 4. The first three verses give the backdrop of this action of the Lord getting up, girding himself, pouring the water into a basin, and going and stooping down before these men and washing their feet. And in this background, you find three things that are, I believe, at the very heart of those things that mar our ministry. All three of them are stated either explicitly or implicitly in verses 1, 2, or 3, any one of which will eliminate you from being a serious contender for the place of servitude. And that's the road to greatness in the kingdom. But Jesus Christ eliminated all three of these and became the perfect example of a minister of God. And I mention it to us tonight because I believe that we ought to imitate him. We've got a task ahead of us here in this congregation I believe, that's unparalleled anywhere in the entire world. But if we're not equipped for it, and if we're not yielded to the point that we say, Lord, please divest me of whatever it is, cleanse me of whatever it may be that stands between me and meaningful ministry. If we're not willing and able and ready and in the process of doing this, we're not going to be able to do the task that's ahead of us. There are three things, and I'm going to mention them to you. These are the things, and Jesus, when he acknowledges these things, and as we find him washing the feet of these men in the face of these things, Jesus Christ strikes a death blow at these things that mar our ministry. Number one, it says that Jesus Christ knew who he was. It says knowing that he was from God and that he was going to God and knowing that God had committed everything into his hands. Jesus washed these men's feet. He washed them knowing his own divine nature. Well, what has that got to do with it? Just simply this. I think one of the most outstanding impediments to meaningful service is this awareness of your superior position by your own accomplishments or your own merit. Do you understand what I mean? By being aware that you know that you're somebody. It says that Jesus knew, or knowing, this is a participle, knowing that he was from God, and knowing that he was going back to God, and knowing that God had committed everything into his hand, then he washed their feet. He knew who he was, and he knew that his nature was such that it was certainly superior to theirs. He knew who he was by his own origin. He was something sure enough. And yet, in the face of that, he washed their feet. I wonder how many of us have at one time or other been eliminated from meaningful ministry because of some overemphasis upon our own worth. After all, you know, I've got a PhD degree. I don't, but some of you do. Let me ask you, what happened when you got your PhD degree? Did it alter your attitude toward your students? When you got your PhD degree, did you feel kind of like you'd carved yourself out a niche and you were there, you know, and you were really, you couldn't be unseated? Were you tempted to say, all right, I've kind of got it made. I don't really have to grovel and sweat it out and pull myself out for people like I maybe at one time had to do. What was your response to your receiving your PhD? Unless I miss my guess, you're going to have to wrestle with this very attitude that eliminates most people from meaningful service. And that is their awareness of what they feel like their superior worth is. After all, who can expect a PhD to stay on campus longer than his classes? And after all, shouldn't PhDs just really have to teach just one or two classes a week? After all, they don't have to do all this other, do they? After all, well, not unless you want to minister. And I'm not out after PhDs. I have a book coming out shortly. I've already seen something in me that I don't like. I've already come to the conclusion I'm going to have to wrestle with myself because I believe it's a book that's worthwhile, and I've already seen in me this tendency to think, just as soon as I get this thing out, everything's going to be all right. I believe I can really sit back and take it easy, and I think I'll just, you know, there it is, that old thing raising its head saying, well, Jesus didn't do that. Knowing that he was from God, and knowing that he was going to God, and knowing that God had given all things into his hand, he didn't operate from a position of weakness. This man operated from the position of the podium of the Almighty God. He stood in the standing of the Almighty God, not from a position of weakness, but knowing that God had committed everything into his hands. He had it made. And it was then that he took off his robe and girded himself with a towel and stooped down before mortal men and washed their feet. Now there's meaningful service. But a second thing that he did, it says, knowing also, it says that the devil having already entered into the heart of Judas. Do you know what this says? That Jesus washed their feet, not only knowing his own divine nature, but he washed their feet knowing their sinful nature. Now the implication there is simply this. A second most outstanding flaw in our character that eliminates us from meaningful ministry is our looking down our nose at someone else just simply because we don't think they're worthy of our efforts. Not because of what we've done necessarily, but because of the fact that we know their background. We know them. And consequently, we say, well, I'm not going to serve you. We know their tendencies. We know their weaknesses. We know how that they're not really scholarly. We know how they'd rather major in campusology than study. We know a lot of things about them. I've had you for 3 years in my class. I know you. He washed Judas' feet. In spite of all that Judas had stolen from the band, he washed his feet. He washed Judas' feet in spite of what Judas was about to do. He had already made a preliminary arrangement, and immediately after this supper, he went out, after the washing of the feet, he went out and finalized those arrangements and made the meeting place definite. Jesus knew all of that, and yet he washed Judas's feet anyway. He washed Simon Peter's feet, knowing full well that Simon was going to deny him 3 times. He washed these men in spite of the fact that he knew their sinful nature. He washed Thomas's feet, knowing that Thomas wasn't going to believe in the resurrection. He washed all these men, knowing full well that they would all be scattered from him that very night, and they would all go to their own homes, and they would all deny. But loving care and divine love caused this one to forgive these men and minister to them. Just like he forgave those men who crucified him when he prayed, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And by the giving of his own body on the cross, he served all of us who nail nails into his hands. He just keeps on forgiving and keeps on serving. How many times have you been disqualified from serving some poor, wretched, unworthy human being because you knew that they really weren't worthy of it? Have you ever done that? I have. But not the Lord. Well, there's a third thing that he did. He washed these men's feet under the immediate shadow of his own death. This is the third thing that usually eliminates us from meaningful service. And I mean by that, the implication is simply that our extenuating circumstances. We feel our rights have been violated. After all, do we not have any rights? All of us as ministers of Christ, do we not have any rights? Are we at all times at the beck and call of people who have need? Is there nothing that we have to say about it? And I won't answer that yes or no. There is probably a point at which you do not serve a person's well-being by continually being at their beck and call. That's left up to each minister. But I feel that there must be a basic understanding here made and met and grappled with. One of the outstanding means by which we are eliminated from doing meaningful service is we feel that our rights have been violated. Our privacy has been invaded. Here Jesus was involved in the very giving of his life. He was not 18 hours away from it. He hanged on the cross, or hung, I don't know what the verb is, I can't get that one, but he hung there for 6 solid hours, from 6 o'clock, or from the ninth hour, from the third hour to the ninth hour, from 9 o'clock in the morning till 3 o'clock in the afternoon, before he died. 6 hours. He wasn't 18 hours away from that. If there was ever an opportunity or ever an occasion for someone to have said, "My time is mine, and I'm on my way to the cross. Leave me alone." How often we have justified under such periods of crisis like this, how many times we've justified flying off the handle, losing our temper, losing our patience. Well, what's the justification for it? This one, that our rights have been taken away from us, that our privacy has been invaded. But Jesus didn't do that. How gently he searches his mind, and how kindly he knelt before those men and showed by his actual example what it really and truly meant to serve. And so he qualified as the great master teacher. How many times have you been hindered and kept from meaningful ministry by feeling that your rights have been violated? As I look into my heart, and I've been made to, as I look into my heart and as I constantly do it, as we're called upon and you're called upon for service and you need to look into your heart, I find that these three things are cardinal sins that will eliminate me from being really and truly the minister that I want to be. It will either be through a false sense of importance, or through looking down my nose at someone whose past I'm aware of, and whom I know really, of whom I know things that disqualify them, and say, well, they're not really worthy. Or because of a pressing schedule, or because of something that I feel like is my right, these three things, I think, will eliminate you or me. And it'll eliminate all of us at one time or other. And if we don't do something about it, then we're not going to be the ministers that are qualified to do this work that's coming up in about 2 or 3 weeks. And it'll be on you for 9 months. And it'll be on you for the rest of your life. But how beautifully Jesus gave himself. What an astonishing living demonstration of the statement and the description that Paul makes of Jesus when he said, though he was in the form of God, he counted not the being on an equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself, taking upon himself the form of a servant. What a magnificent demonstration of that beautiful truth. No wonder Paul wrote that. Who, though existing in the form of God, didn't count something like that to be grasped and held to himself in selfishness, but he emptied himself, pouring himself out, taking upon himself the form of a servant. What a beautiful demonstration of what he said to the Ephesians, how Christ gave himself up for the church. Having sanctified it by the washing of water with the word, here's a perfectly beautiful demonstration of that. And so we see his life exonerated. We see his claims exonerated. We see his claims verified. Jesus had said earlier, the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. So sure enough, here you find him under the pressures now of his own death, under the pressures of what we find it would be crushing and would make all of us, having established such a policy as that, review it with very serious consideration of abandoning it. We find Jesus of Nazareth loving them, it says, having loved his own that were in the world, he loved them to the end. In other words, he never backed off. He went right on through with his ministry to them. And tonight, we're confronted with that very ministry as he gives us the perfect example for service. Will you look into your heart, and will you help me look into mine? Oh, to be like thee, blessed Redeemer, this is my constant longing and prayer. If this is what we really mean, then we'll follow the life and the example of this one who set such a beautiful example of mercy and ministry. May God bless us as we continue to prepare our hearts for expanded service.
Obedience to the command, baptized into his death, penitence, putting the